say on the question of motion army, a number of us were actually involved in the demonstrations that took place in Rotherham, because the fascists arrived time and time and time again, and we opposed them, and we were there, and we demonstrated when Mohsin Ahmed was murdered. And you're right, I mean, it used to be the black mugger, now it's the Muslim terrorist, now it's the Muslim groomer, and we have to defy and fight back against these things. So that's what we've been doing. Our next speaker, really, I think many people will have heard of Mozambique. To be honest, I think he is an absolute hero. He spent 3 years locked up in Guantanamo Bay and was then rearrested again in his country. And to be honest, his crime is that he opposes British foreign policy around the world. That's what he's guilty of nothing else at all. So I'd like a massive round of applause.
In the name of Allah, most compassionate and most merciful. Thank you for that introduction, and to everybody here for coming. Such a wonderful turnout. Speaking at a place that's known as the City of Refuge, I think in Britain is quite unique. I've spoken at Sheffield many times and have always marvelled at the sorts of responses I've seen here. Your pioneering in coming forward to stand up against racism, Islamophobia, welcome refugees. It's a place, I think, where people, let alone refugees, people like me, feel welcome all the time. Just a few weeks ago, I was walking or driving in the streets of Sparfield, which is a predominantly Asian area, Ladypool Road, which is famous for its our version of the Balti Belt. And you'll be shocked, as I was driving along and turned onto Ladypool Road, I saw somebody who looked very much like Tony Robinson. And it turned out that it was Tony Robinson. So I sped the car and went straight for him, not to hit him. Because he happened to be with a friend of mine who'd come to debate him. But I parked right next to him, and Tony took a step back. I jumped out and said, "Tony Robinson, what are you doing here?" He said, "Mozambique." And his back was up against the wall. And then I saw my friend who was here with him. And I said, "What are you doing with Tommy?" He said, "I've invited him to debate with me about something." And I was wondering that, you know, Tommy Robinson had announced, remember, he was the leader of the EDL, the English Defence League, that movement, that grassroots movement, that wanted to stand up for everything that was English and British and kick out people like me and immigrants and everybody else, and to stand up against them. So he was de-radicalized, as you must have heard, by the Quilliam Foundation. And he's the only person that I know that's gone through a de-radicalization program and joined a worse group. So he left Quilliam and he joined Pegida. Now Pegida, this is really important, because they marched, they did end up marching in Birmingham a couple of weeks ago, but it was a washout. Literally, hardly anybody turned up, and it was raining, by providence, and he came, he went, and nobody noticed. And that's a success in one sense, because the EDL really is, as one of the interviewers was asking him on one of the radio shows, why should anybody believe a former football hooligan who's got a string of prison convictions? And the truth is that the EDL perhaps doesn't matter so much as it does, as does the rise of racism and Islamophobia in the mainstream. Yeah. Now, on the one hand, we can pat ourselves on the back to say that these racist organizations that exist are on the demise, but actually, when they see that our Prime Minister himself can stand up in a school, the school where my son goes to, that same son who was born while I was in Guantanamo, being tortured with the complicity of British intelligence, that Prime Minister can say that anybody who fails to adhere to the rule of law, i.e. the British value of the rule of law, is an extremist. He doesn't see the irony in the fact that he's talking about this at the school where this child has been born and brought up, rather, where his father is detained, abused, with the complicity of British agents. Where's the rule of law there? Who's the extremist here? And the truth is that, as previous speakers have said, that the ordinary man on the street, he doesn't get his ideas from nowhere. They drop like a penny from the top, and somebody's dropping those pennies. And it's those people that we've invested with power that are supposed to be representing us, making things safer. But in fact, what you've seen now, the very people who did the least to help the refugees, particularly in Syria, were on the bandwagon of those who were causing the problem in the first place. Now, what do I mean by this? I don't say Britain created the problem in Syria, but they did create the problem in Iraq. Based upon, first, the dodgy dossier and the torture of a man called Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi. And as a result of that, Britain, hand in hand, went into Iraq and invaded and created the dungeons and the torture centres in Abu Ghraib and in Camp Bukha. And when you see then that ISIS dresses its hostages in orange and executes them, who dresses their victims and their prisoners in orange? We used to think that it was some sort of solidarity with the Guantanamo people, but it isn't. It's to do with their own experience in Iraq. They were dressed in orange in Camp Bukha. 17 of the leaders of ISIS, that horrible organization that beheaded more Muslims than it ever beheaded Western hostages. That group of people was executing people dressed in orange suits because of their own experience in Camp Bukha, run by the Americans and where British intelligence was regularly present. Now, one of the reasons why I and the organization I work with, CAGE, and many others have been constantly targeted is primarily this. We've never harmed anyone. We've never been involved in a plot to harm anyone. We don't want to harm anyone. We want to see a mutual society filled with love, peace, and respect. But we have been harmed. We have been targeted. We have had our homes raided, kicked down, our children scattered across several homes while 100 police officers go through every aspect of your life, and held in prison for months, and then told at the end of that process, you're an innocent man. But this is just me. Imagine the hundreds of other people who've been arrested and detained and stopped and searched at ports of entry and exit under Schedule 7 of the Terrorism Act 2000. The experience now is becoming so commonplace that I think every Muslim has been affected by anti-terror legislation in this country. And it's not just the legislation, it's the media gone wild. The same media, the same Daily Mail, as we were told. We remember their attitude, the same Daily Mail that in the 30s and the 40s welcomed Oswald Mosley in his black shirts, praised Hitler, and supported his rise in taking over of Czechoslovakia. Today, they draw in caricature the refugees running from the streets or from the shores of Turkey, along with the rats that they're depicted to be. Now, what happens when you start depicting and describing human beings as rats and cockroaches, like what that woman called Katie Hopkins? These are the sorts of people that the ordinary, as it were, British person, if there's such a thing, because I'm going to mention, I'm going to talk about that in a bit, are being subjected to. We're told that in North Korea, people are forced to hear things and forced to adhere to a certain ideology. Well, we're being forced here too. We're being subjected to this type of language and caricature too, and told as a result of this, refugees are not welcome. They don't belong. They have a different culture, a different ideology. We've been told in some places, like in Hungary, well, the only refugees will allow the Christian ones, which is the most unchristian thing to say. And I have to say at this point, it's really important. We're speaking in a church, and I have to thank the people there. Because one of the things that's happened as a result of the self-censorship that's forced upon the Muslim community is you can't have an event like this in a mosque. They are terrified. I remember just a few months ago, we were speaking about a major conference of Islamophobia in Scotland. Right next to, inside the Methodist Church, was the largest mosque in that city, who I'm sure are concerned about the issues of Islamophobia, but they're too afraid to do so, too afraid to talk about it. They think they'll put on some sort of a terrorist. And here's the problem, because now everything's terrorism, everything's extremism, everybody's a radical. Even the good terms that, you know, we used to hear about the thing about radical politics. The suffragettes were radicals. It was through their struggles that the women got the vote here. But now it's a bad term because it's associated with Islam. And Islam is something bad. And we're told that people who don't speak English are Muslims primarily, and primarily Muslim women. Well, let me tell you something. Let me tell the Prime Minister something about language, because I'm going to go off on a little tangent here, if I'm allowed to do so. During an interrogation by the CIA in 2004 in Guantanamo, one of these agents, he drew up an algebraic equation, x plus y equals z. He said, x is you, y is the information we think we have on you, and z equals terrorist. I said, algebra. I was crap at algebra at school. It terrified me. Now, I know you're terrified of Islamic concepts and so forth, political jihadis and Islamists and so forth. But, and I agree with you, because algebra terrifies every teenager studying mathematics. But let me give you a list of other words that also might give you, enlighten you as to what Islam and the Arabic language has contributed to the one that you're speaking today. The word algebra, of course, comes from the Arabic to fix, but also you've got algorithms. Without algorithms, from Abu Musa and Khawarizmi algorithm, you wouldn't have computers today. If it wasn't for the camera, developing the camera obscura, and the word in Urdu for camera, actually, camera is a room. In Arabic, the word for camera is ghurfa, because it was from inside being in that room, when the light was inverted, that we found out that this is a place where you can take, or eventually take, pictures. The word Arsenal, that quintessential English football team, they're called the Gunners, right? Because it comes from Dar, As-Sinah, and As-Sihah, the place of manufacture of weapons. Radical, right? We wouldn't have, if it wasn't for the Arabic language, magazines comes from the Arabic word makhzan, which means a place to store. We wouldn't have sherbet or syrup or any of these words which come from the Arabic word shurba, which means drink or to drink. There are a whole series of words. From Hindi, you get mantra, and you get shampoo, and even pajamas. Yogurt is a Turkish word. So what I'm leading to over here is, who controls language anyway? Who develops it? Who's in charge? What makes these words yours? How come they're English when they're originally Arabic? And outside Parliament, you've got the statue of this great English warrior called Richard the Lionheart, who couldn't speak a word of English, and who, if he could, he says that he would sell London if he found a buyer. And if you thought that wasn't strange enough, the current royal family, what are they called? What's their name? Windsor, right? But what were they really called? Saxe, Coburg, Gotha. The name was changed. Saxe, Coburg, Gotha. Vague sounds more English than Saxe, Coburg, Gotha. And they changed it during the First World War because it sounded more English. So, what is this? And what's English? Where did the word England come from? Anglo, which is in Germany. Where does the word Britain come from? Brittany, which is in France. So, what do we do with this? Who is real? Who has the right here? Who has more importance than anybody else? The answer is nobody. Which race takes precedence? The answer is the human race. Because that is the only race that exists. There's a verse in the Quran which I will quote, which says, يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسُ إِنَّا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ مِنْ ذَكَرٍ وَأُنْثَى وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ شُعُوبًا وَقَبَائِلَ لِتَعَارَفُوا إِنَّ أَكْرَمَكُمْ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ أَتْقَاكُمْ. O mankind, we created you from a man and from a woman, from a male and from a female, and we made you into tribes and nations, so that you come to know one another. The best of you, in the sight of the Lord, is he who has the most consciousness of the Lord. That's the criteria. We're in a place of worship here. And the point of us being here is to come to know one another. And when we think we're better than the other, that's where we make the mistake. When we were held by the Americans in Guantanamo and Bagram, they brought us first into custody. They abused us and tortured us and spat upon us and stripped us naked. They brought dogs to salivate upon us, and they made us watch that happen to other people while they were crying in tears. And while that was going on, they were saying, you are now the property of the United States of America and you have no rights because you're not a human. You are now enemy aliens. An enemy and an alien. You're no longer human. You have been subjected to this, you've been brought to the subhuman level whereby your humanity has been lost. And you see, when you do that in a place like where there's no accountability, and you've already been told by your peers and by people who are in charge that you are animals, then the rest is easy. To torture someone is easy. To abuse someone is easy. To kill someone is easy. And it's been mentioned already this evening that the Muslim woman is probably the most visible target of the racists nowadays because of how she appears, because of her faith, because of her choice. And you can see how often they're spat at, kicked, punched, thrown against moving trains, punched in the face till they're knocked down to the ground. What kind of cowardice is this? Where's the Britishness in all of this? Where's the great sense that everybody understood that you don't try to harm a woman, let alone anybody else? It's gone out the window. So all of these proponents of Englishness and Britishness, all that kind of nonsense that we've debunked just now, doesn't mean anything. You've just got to stand with people and ensure that when you harm one, you're essentially telling them that you're harming all of us, that we stand firm. We may have our differences, our different beliefs and so forth, but in this we must be united. And, you know, one of the things that's also been mentioned here is prevent. And it is important that we mention this at the level of at where it's supposed to be understood. And that is universities and places where people go to think. That's where minds develop. And that's where you'll find that the universities are the strongest opponents of prevent. There was this article in the Daily Express, and they've been hammering me and my organisation, Cage, calling zealots and fanatics and extremists and radicals and what else. But they said that Cage is trying to develop an army of people, an army of Islamists to stop prevent. And in the chat line, it's brilliant. Their army will consist of doctors, lecturers, and students. As opposed to armies of Daily Express, Sun readers, and Daily Mail readers. So I'm just going to stop here and simply say that initiatives like this evening are really important because it gives us, anybody who's been taught, anybody, I mean, whichever minority background you're from, you get a sense of solidarity. And sometimes when you're being targeted, you really feel alone. And if there's nobody there to support you, you will fall. So it is crucial that you stand firm with your brothers and sisters in humanity and ensure that they don't fall because you're there to support. Thank you.